Hi, this is Arnie Arneson, and this is the Thursday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and producer Stephanie Collins and Dave Scott. I want to remind everyone that we Zoom on Wednesday in order to provide you with a show on Thursday. So if something should happen on Wednesday night, you're not going to know about it. Anyway, before we begin our show, you have come to expect this. You will absolutely hear this between now and November. You are going to hear the powerful testimony of Lieutenant Colonel Vindman in the fall of 2019 before the impeachment hearings. We then later saw his brother, his twin brother, and he, you know, basically almost perp walked out of the White House in February of 2020. But again, this testimony is important. I want you to have it ringing in your ears before the election of 2020. And of course, I also want you to remember a couple of other things. Remember Wisconsin, and if you were following what happened in Georgia, Wisconsin looked like a cakewalk compared to the sort of fallout in Georgia with their primary election just this week. All right, everyone, Lieutenant Colonel Vindman.
Next month will mark 40 years since my family arrived in the United States as refugees. When my father was 47 years old, he left behind his entire life and the only home he had ever known to start over in the United States so his three sons could have a better and safer lives. His courageous decision inspired a deep sense of gratitude in my brothers and myself and instilled in us a sense of duty and service. All three of us have served or are currently serving in the military. My little brother sits behind me here today. Our collective military service is a special part of our family's history, a story in America. I'm grateful for my father's brave act of hope 40 years ago and for the privilege of being an American citizen and public servant, where I can live free and free of fear for mine and my family's safety. Dad, I'm sitting here today in the U.S. Capitol talking to our elected professionals. Talking to our elected professionals is proof that you made the right decision 40 years ago to leave the Soviet Union and come here to the United States of America in search of a better life for our family. Do not worry. I will be fine for telling the truth. Thank you again for your consideration. I'll be happy to answer your questions.
So, I love the American Prospect. I know almost every single person who writes for the American Prospect. I don't know this man, however. But I have been going to it and following it for years. And it has become an important resource. Max Morin has written a piece about a gentleman that I had posted on my Facebook page about a couple weeks before he actually wrote his piece. I wrote, Rahm Emanuel, I despise this man. Now, why would I suddenly like pull a name out of the hat, a former mayor of Chicago, and actually post it on my Facebook page? Because there was a rumor that Rahm Emanuel, I'm not sure whether it came out of the Biden campaign or out of Rahm Emanuel, that somehow he was providing guidance to the Biden campaign. And I started screaming, oh God, no. I saw two pieces. One was a piece from May 29th by Robert Kuttner entitled, Say It Ain't So, Joe. Rahm Emanuel with a question mark? And then this guy dug real deep. Max Morin wrote a piece entitled, Rahm Emanuel, the worst man for the moment. I could have written that headline. It's not clear whether Emanuel is just bloviating about being a top advisor to the presumptive Democratic presidential nominee, but we should hope he is. So let me welcome Max to the program. And Max, before you get into discussion of your article, there are two things I want to point out. One is your comment about whether he's bloviating. I just want to remind everyone that one of the things that people do when they have a new book out is they throw stuff at the wall, like maybe I'm working on the Biden campaign. I just want people to probably not buy this book, but Rahm Emanuel has just written a new book called The Nation City, Why Mayors Are Now Running the World. And I'm thinking, yeah, and if you watch how he ran Chicago, maybe not so good. Anyway, you don't just write for the American Prospect. You actually work with another organization that is also near and dear to my heart. Because as someone who served in the New Hampshire legislature, ran for governor, and ran for Congress, I was very sensitive to people that did something that I would refer to as the revolving door. And it turns out that there's now a project called the Revolving Door Project. So just quickly share with my audience a little bit about this. And Rahm Emanuel is kind of your poster child.
Yeah, thanks so much for having me on, first of all. I work with a group called the Revolving Door Project. Our focus is on basically trying to educate Democrats and the progressive movement about the importance of what's called personnel as policy. This is actually a term Ronald Reagan, of all people, coined, which basically highlights that if you're the president, essentially as far as enacting your domestic agenda goes, basically your job is to be a really good delegator, because the people who you appoint to various jobs, to your attorney general, your chief of staff, your treasury secretary, those are the people who have actual authority in order to enact the regulations, enact the rules that you want to bring about. And so the people who a president surrounds themselves with matter in some cases even more than the specific policy plans, specific policy proposals which they put out. So it really, really matters who a president surrounds themselves with. And Rahm Emanuel in some ways is a poster child of what can go wrong when a president surrounds themselves with bad people. He's probably most famous to some of your listeners for being Barack Obama's first chief of staff. And when he was, Emanuel did basically everything that he could in order to stop and sort of neuter the transformational agenda that Obama ran on. So he tried to prevent economic estimates of the kind of stimulus that was needed to prevent the Great Recession from even reaching Obama's ears, because he was too afraid of spending a lot of money. When the Obamacare fight was going on, Rahm Emanuel, at the first sign of trouble, wanted to pare everything down to the smallest possible bill. It took Nancy Pelosi fighting back against him in order to actually get Obamacare passed. And the chief of staff is a very important position, I should also say, because the chief of staff basically determines what ends up in front of the president's
desk. He's the gatekeeper. I want to go back to one of your first points, and then we'll continue the conversation about Rahm Emanuel, because I want everyone to know everything about him. But one of the things I think is so interesting is you mentioned personnel as policy. You heard Elizabeth Warren say that a lot on the campaign trail. You've heard me say this a lot, Stephanie, you know, and Dave, you know, I say it all the time, that personnel is policy. And I just want to remind everyone what that really means. In a lot of ways, everyone that you employ, not only are they kind of searching around for information and are gatekeepers to information, but really in a lot of ways, every single person you appoint to your cabinet has what I call prosecutorial discretion. You think that only applies to prosecutors, but it applies to everyone in personnel, because it's where they put their energy. It's the issues that they care about. It's where they direct their staff. It's where they put the pressure on. And it's not like there isn't a law in front of them. There are lots of laws in front of them. There are lots of regulations in front of them. But you know what? You're not going to do them all. You're not going to have the same emphasis on them all. I remember when I was running for governor, someone said to me, Arnie, I care about this. Arnie, I care about that. And I looked at them and I said, I'm going to be really honest with you. We're experiencing the worst economic downturn since the Great Depression. This is 1991 and 1992. There is so much on everyone's plate. I am going to triage. These are the three things I will be focusing an incredible amount of attention to. Not that I don't care about the other things, but if I am going to be effective, I can't spread myself so thin that I will be incapable of doing it. I need to prioritize, and let me explain to you why I am doing this. So I warned people ahead of time that, yes, this is important. It's not in my hand right now because I have other things I need to do. And if I can address them, yes, we will get to that. But please understand. So your point is so well taken. And as chief of staff, I mean, if I'm frustrated with Barack Obama, I will point a lot of blame at Rahm Emanuel. Because one, I think Obama made a huge mistake by choosing him. I mean, I was appalled by that. But then when you begin to realize what he wanted to do, for example, with the 2008 economic bailout, I mean, you know, everybody knew that he probably needed to do 1.8 trillions or billions of dollars, and he wanted to shrink it. Why? Because he was going to leave workers left on the street. He was going to leave Main Street ignored. So what? So he could continue to serve Wall Street. Okay, so let's go through a whole sort of history of Rahm Emanuel so that people understand it's not just the chief of staff where he sucked, but that there is really a pattern and practice, which is why Joe Biden, don't even think about it.
Okay, I guess I would say that there's sort of like three eras of Rahm Emanuel that you should understand. The first era is when he's first sort of rising up in politics. He's a major part of the New Democrat movement, which is essentially the movement to shift the Democratic Party away from its working class base, away from the union base, and towards Wall Street, towards big dollar donations. He once famously said the first two-thirds of your campaign should be money, 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 and money, money, money. He was one of the originators of the big dollar fundraising model that absolutely everybody despises. In 2006, he credits himself very deeply for helping Democrats to win the House in 2006, even though analysis at the time actually showed that essentially most of the campaigns which he funneled tons and tons of amount of money and effort and energy into, very few of them even won. There was almost no enthusiasm on the ground, and a lot of the candidates who were really enthusiastic supporters of their community, people who like actually understood what the people in their communities wanted, he cast them aside because in his image, they didn't fit what he wanted a Democrat to look like. And in other words, they didn't fit this sort of heavily corporate, heavily pro-business kind of image. The second sort of phase of Rahm Emanuel I would identify is his time as chief of staff, which we've already touched upon. And then the last I'd say is most recently he was the mayor of Chicago. It was basically a nonstop string of scandals, the most noteworthy of which right now is the Laquan McDonald shooting. Laquan McDonald was a teenager, African-American kid, and there was a dash cam video of him walking away from police officers, and an officer shot him 17 times in the back. We now know through Freedom of Information Act requests that Emanuel's office was aware of this dash cam video for, I think it was 9 months before it went public. The mayor's office fought tooth and nail in a legal battle to prevent this dash cam video from going public. And in fact, they only released their settlements with the family, which included releasing some elements of the video and their information about it, the week after Rahm Emanuel was reelected. They staggered things out so that Emanuel could win his reelection before full story came out to the public.
You're in the revolving door project. So there's a revolving door aspect to Rahm Emanuel that you need to do because it was incredibly lucrative for him. And
oh,
I always say that one of the reasons why, since this is your area of expertise, one of the reasons why people need to be very aware of the revolving door project and things like the revolving door is that what you find out is that politicians go into the private sector, then they go from the private sector back into politics, and they go back into the private sector. Now, what we're going, well, why would they do this? They get paid so much more in the private sector. Why would they want to go back into politics? Well, because the reason why they get paid so much in the private sector is because they were in politics. And the reason why they get continued to pay so much is that they go back into politics. So you think of the revolving door as like, you know, a check inside the drawer. We're going to pay you now, so you only get paid $100,000 later. So explain to everyone a little bit about Rahm Emanuel's revolving door, because again, every time I think about him, I want to take a shower, but this just adds to it.
You articulated it absolutely perfectly, is that Emanuel has gone back and forth between Wall Street firms and these boutique investment banks and so on. The man has like, you know, it's got nothing to do with any sort of financial brilliance of his. He does not have any financial brilliance. What he has is political connections. What he does is he goes into politics in opportune moments, so like during the Great Recession, the 2008 financial crisis. And he keeps his buddies from facing any real accountability for anything that that's going to happen to them. Then he gets he revolves back out and he takes multi-million dollar checks. He gets these senior executive level appointments. Most recently, he was in a firm with Robert Rubin, who was another one of the sort of originators of this, or the main people of this in the Democratic Party. His job is not to have any kind of brilliance or any kind of understanding of investments. His job is to shield Wall Street from any kind of accountability over anything.
Exactly. So, all right, let me go back to the American Prospect. You're going to see it'll be posted on our Facebook page. Rahm Emanuel, the worst man for the moment. It's not clear whether Emanuel is bloviating, please God, about being a top advisor to the presumptive Democratic presidential nominee, but we should hope so. So one of the other things that I find very interesting, I've known Joe Biden for years. I mean, I've been covering presidential politics probably before you were born. So I've been doing this for a long time. One of the fascinating things about watching the Biden campaign this time, he has run before, was that he really was wallpaper. Nobody thought he was going anywhere. He didn't have any policy agenda. He basically said, you know, in a way, he was running as sort of the third term of Barack Obama. Like, that just doesn't sell, okay? First of all, he's not as articulate. He's not black. And he's an old man, you know? And I'm looking at him going, all right, well, this isn't going anywhere. And then all of a sudden, now he's our presumptive nominee. But what I think is fascinating, again, I want to get back to Rahm, is that Rahm, I think, is a little concerned about Joe Biden. Because Joe Biden basically sort of said, I'm going to take you back to when things were stable, when you felt more secure, when there was someone that you could admire in the White House. And I am just going to sort of create this sort of level of consistency and continuity. And I am not going to be like Bernie and Elizabeth, a revolutionary. Well, that's sort of how he ran, all right? Well, in the last couple of weeks, I'm hearing words like revolution. I'm hearing things like, you know, healthcare is a right. I'm hearing things and I'm going, be still my heart. Where is this coming from? And then, of course, I read your article, and I've read a series of other articles in the Chicago papers and wherever, and Rahm is not exactly a person you want to bring on your team if you're talking about a revolution, because Rahm, kind of like the wallpaper Joe Biden, he doesn't necessarily like this Joe Biden. And I think that this is a moment where people are looking for change. And they understand the difference between good change and evil change.
That's so, so true. The thing about Joe Biden, like you say, he ran as, again, the third term of Obama, just saying the word Barack Obama over and over and over again in the primary. But also, if you look at his career, he knows which way the wind is blowing, which is not always a good thing. But in some cases, it can be a good thing when the wind is quite clearly blowing towards change, as I think is the case now. And he's seeing how we are in the middle of a pandemic. He's seeing how we're in the middle of a massive movement towards understanding police brutality. Yes, and he's realizing that...
matter, which is really about social underpinnings that have failed that community.
Exactly. And he's seeing all of this and he's realizing, no, there's something that's very real going on here. People desperately want something. And so, again, so far it's just purely a rhetorical choice. We have to see about any kind of actual policy. Biden, again, he has never released the actual names of the economists who are advising his campaign. So it's,
We know Jared Bernstein has been with him for a long time.
Yes, Jared's
pretty good. Yeah,
yes, Jared's wonderful. But again, at least in his rhetoric in the last couple of weeks, he's been talking more about like some real structural changes. And so coincidentally, but not coincidentally, Rahm Emanuel starts talking very loudly at any possibility that he can about how, oh yes, I've been speaking with the Biden campaign at every possibility that I can. And, you know, Joe Biden really deeply values my expertise. And again, this is Rahm, so you've got to take it with an extraordinary fistful of salt. It could very much be that he's basically trying to say over and over how important he is to try to then make himself more and more important. We have not really heard any kind of confirmation about this from the Biden camp. If Rahm Emanuel is trying to sort of sneak his way into Biden's inner circle, then his job there, his goal there is to put any kind of talk of a revolution immediately on the kibosh, to immediately kill any kind of operation about that. Because again, Biden goes which way the wind is blowing, so he can try to make it seem like the wind is blowing against that direction.
Okay, so I just want to mention that when he was mayor of Chicago, they referred to him as the mayor of the 1%. So, I want this article to be like read into Joe Biden's ears. I want him to hear this article going, you sure you want to do this? Okay. Because I think when the message came out, so many of us who know him and have known him for a long time were like, we then looked at Joe Biden as not being trustworthy. I will be honest with you. I've got to trust. I'm exhausted. I've got to trust. I have been trying to explain to people exactly what you said. Joe Biden is really interesting. And don't get angry at me, David. I'm going to say this again. But I always say that Joe Biden leads from behind. I mean, that's like my theme song, okay? I must say it almost three times a week. Yesterday, we did a really interesting interview with Walter Shapiro from The New Republic. And Walter has been covering campaigns for decades. But Walter reminded me something about Joe Biden. I'm going to send you this interview because I think you need to hear it. It was news to me because I didn't focus on this aspect. So he talked about the fact that he's been in the Senate, what, since 1972? What happened is that he has been a representative of Delaware as a U.S. senator, which runs statewide, everyone. I want to remind you, like a presidential campaign, you have to win the state. You don't win a district. He has won in Delaware for the U.S. Senate when Republicans had won 4 out of 5 elections in Delaware. Look at your face. Okay, that was my face. I was like, are you kidding me? You need to hear Walter's explanation of Biden in a way that I had never quite understood. He also talked about, for example, the criminal reform bill. In a lot of ways, he was carrying the weight for Bill Clinton. It wasn't that it was his agenda. It was that Clinton demanded it. Because he was a good Democrat and Clinton was his president, he would go to the mat for Clinton. I, unfortunately, was running for Congress like 1996, and I basically said Clinton was wrong, which is why I'm not elected. But I mean, I did. I said the welfare reform bill sucked, and so did your criminal reform bill suck. And everyone said, you're running against Bill Clinton? I go, I guess I am. You know, I mean, what am I going to do? But that's not something Joe Biden would ever do. And that he saw his job as carrying that weight. So I think your comment about the fact that he really sort of understands the times is not a negative. It's how a lot of people operate. You know, you operate in a way that you sort of, you deal with the hand you're dealt.
Not to mention, it's a good way to stay alive in politics.
Well, especially in politics. And you know that Joe loves it. And Max, I'm going to tell you something. The best job of my life was the 8 years I earned $100 a year as a state rep. I loved it. Let me repeat this, everyone. I loved it. I learned so much. I met the most interesting people. It expanded my worldview. Running for governor was hard because I knew if I lost, I wouldn't be going back. Because there was a piece of it that really, you realize that you have value. And that's one of the reasons a lot of politicians do what they do, is that they really want to think that they have value, not for a negative, but for a positive. I still believe in term limits because I think at some point in time, your value gets a little bit old, but what am I going to do? So as you're talking about this, I think it's really important that Joe Biden is able to hear the moment. But what Rahm Emanuel will do is either attempt to blunt that ability to hear, or if nothing else, send out the worst message for Joe, that can we trust what you say? Because if you really do understand the change that's needed, Rahm has a history of preventing that.
That's so, so true. And, you know, again, it's really important to be able to understand this and to be able to explain this to people on that sort of a nuanced way. Because another thing about Emanuel is that he, in some ways, it's almost kind of Trumpy in that he loves very much to project this tough guy image. He asks people to call him Rambo sometimes. He likes to project this idea of himself as, like, you know, the tough Chicagoan who's gonna like, you know, make the Democrats fight back. Even though if you, again, look at his history, he's honestly quite cowardly. He backs away from any kind of real substantive change that people need, whether that's because he actually, like, you know, is too much of a coward or because he just doesn't want people to prosper in any way. You know, I can't get into the guy's head. I don't know. He is going to try very hard, again, if the Biden campaign is listening to him. He's going to try to present his theory of the electorate, which is going to be that people want a tough guy, at least his idea of a tough guy. That's not what people want. People want change. People want a government that actually tries to help them in some way. And I think that Biden is, at least in some of his public rhetoric, is starting to intuit and understand that. And he's, again, people like Jared Bernstein are trying very hard to make that case to him. Groups like mine and groups like other organizations in the broader progressive movement are trying very hard to say, look, we want to work with you, Joe Biden. We want to help you. We want you to be a really deep success. If you're surrounding yourself with people like Rahm, then you're kind of dooming yourself from the get-go.
So one of the other theories of the case that Rahm has that he wants to sort of recommend to Joe Biden, and again, I've been reading other articles other than yours, was that he wants him to basically say, take away the responsibility of Medicaid and unemployment from the states. Let us take care of it. Now, that sounds pretty good. You know, good. I don't want to have to pay my 50% of the Medicaid dollars or my 20% of the Medicaid dollars, whatever it is, depending on the wealth of the state. And unemployment after the last, you know, pandemic, you know, we're like, oh my God, we're not prepared for this. But let me tell you what's wrong with that. Once again, it's thin soup, okay? And Rahm is good at saying, we're just going to help people who are at the very bottom. We don't want to expand that social safety net. We would rather just deal with Medicaid, not Medicare for all. We would rather deal with unemployment rather than raising wages. So once again, and people need to understand what he's doing. He's doing exactly what he tried to do with the Affordable Care Act. What he's trying to do is just say, oh, we're just going to help a little bit of the people at the bottom, but don't worry about everything else. Mm-hmm. And I'm going to end with a story for you because again, Max, I've been around this way too long. I was running against the Welfare Reform Act and obviously hated by a lot of Democrats, but also hated by a lot of other people, including conservative Republicans. And I went into a room with a lot of conservative Republican men in a very poor town. And they said to me, we hate you, Arne Larson. And I looked at them and I said, really, have we met? And the reason why they said they hated me was because I opposed the Welfare Reform Act. And here's what they said to me. They said, Arne, we work 60, 70, and sometimes 80 hours a week, and we don't have healthcare, but those welfare women do. We work 60, 70, and 80 hours a week, and we can't send our kids to after school care, but those folks have different kinds of support systems for their children. We work 60, 70, and 80 hours a week, and sometimes we wonder whether there'll be enough money to pay for food at the end of the month. But they have their food stamps, they have their Section 8 housing, and they said, we hate you because you support them. And I listened to them and I went, boy, I understand why you're angry. And I said, but I'm confused. How does taking those things away from welfare get it for you? And I said, you know what I'm hearing from you? I'm not hearing that there's something wrong with welfare. I'm hearing there's something wrong with work. Mm-hmm. When you can work so hard and not go to a doctor when you're sick, when you can work so hard and not be able to pay the mortgage or the rent or the property taxes or put food on the table, it isn't because of welfare. It's because of work.
Amen.
And that's the difference between Arne Arneson and Rahm Emanuel. Rahm Emanuel wants you to focus on welfare as if, oh, we'll tweak that. No. If we focus on work, then welfare won't be an issue. We won't see people at work at Walmart on welfare, and we will have raised the level of opportunity for everyone. So Max Warren, keep writing this stuff. I'll keep calling you up. Thank the American Prospect for putting you on. And I'm glad there's something called the Revolving Door Project. We need to be aware of it because it's dangerous to democracy. So thank you for joining me.
My pleasure. Thanks so much.
You're welcome. All right, everyone, stick around. When we come back, the 19th Amendment. It gave people like me the right to vote. I'll be right back.
A tiny green insect does major damage. On this current cast. Tens of millions of ash trees in the U.S. have fallen victim to an invasive insect called the emerald ash borer. That's not just a problem for forest. Trees are important for water quality.
The roots help control the nitrates and phosphates, which are some of the pollutants that can enter streams and waterways. They also hold the soil in place.
Alicia Trexler of the Western Pennsylvania Conservancy has organized numerous tree plantings in her state. She says she no longer plants ash trees at these events.
I don't want to plant food for bugs.
And she's not alone. Many communities have stopped planting ash and have begun monitoring and management efforts to try to protect existing trees. Current Cast, produced with Cornell's Atkinson Center for a Sustainable Future and made possible by the Foundation for Pennsylvania Watersheds. Online at currentcast.org.
they say time heals everything, but I'm still waiting.
Welcome back to Part Deux of the Thursday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and Dave Scott and Stephanie Collins, my wonderful producers. So there's a lot of reasons why I wanted to grab this article at the conversation. One, because you know I'm the biggest proponent of everyone should be reading the conversation because it's just so invaluable and it's getting such smart people to write stuff in their area of expertise. The reason why this article jumped out at me was probably threefold. It was entitled 19 Facts About the 19th Amendment on its 100th Anniversary. 1920, 2020, it's been 100 years. And as you've heard, and probably the reason I stay so politically engaged, is that voting matters. We know that. We know that. We're horrified by what we saw in Georgia just this week. But one of the things we've been hearing about over and over again is the importance of women and voting. And while there were a disappointment after they got the right to vote with a sort of small percentage of women that actually showed up and exercised the franchise in 1920, that's not the case today. The case today is women turn out to be the majority of people that show up and vote. And if we're talking about the 2020 election, we hear over and over again the importance of Black women votes. That is where the focus is. So obviously the idea that women get the franchise is so important, that they exercise the franchise is more important. Now the question is whether they're going to ultimately get the sort of parity and change that they deserve and probably expected after 1920. And the other reason why I wanted to do the 19 facts about the 19th Amendment is I know Diane Byford, and she is the former director of the Carrie Chapman Katz Center for Women and Politics at Iowa State University. As she knows so well, I've been hanging out in Iowa for a long time. I know Stefan Schmidt from Iowa State. For about a decade, I actually did Iowa Public Radio with Stefan almost every week, talking about politics. And I spoke at the Carrie Chapman Center, and I found it something that was incredibly valuable and I think important for all of us to be aware of, because we really, if we understand our history, we'll understand the policies that we need to change. There is now a new director. So Karen, I want you to introduce yourself since I don't know you. Let people know who you are, a little bit of your history, and now you are in charge of the Carrie Chapman's Katz Center.
Yeah, thanks Arnie for the invitation and hello to all your listeners. I'm Karen Kudrowski and I'm a political scientist. Both Diane and I received our PhDs from the University of Oklahoma. And before coming to Iowa State and returning to the Midwest, I spent 24 and a half years at Winthrop University in Rock Hill, South Carolina. I'm an American politics specialist. I've done a lot of research and teaching in the field of gender and politics. And then while I was at Winthrop, I also held a number of administrative positions, including department chair and dean of arts and sciences. And I really launched the civic engagement initiatives that the university has, especially in terms of student voter engagement. And I'm able to bring all of that over to Iowa State. And it has been an absolutely wonderful experience and a very welcoming community. And I'm happy to be here.
Well, I'm going to give you an assignment at the end of this half hour. So let me tell you, but I have two things. I have two things. One is when I was a fellow at Harvard, they assigned me the old room of Bella Abzug, that incredible liberal from New York who used to wear the hat, one of the most outspoken feminists you will ever meet. I decided that I was going to name my course that I was teaching at Harvard after a great quote by Bella. And the quote by Bella was this: "You have to lose, lose, lose to win." That is the story of the suffragettes. They understood that losing wasn't an ending, but it was part of a staircase. You know, they had to keep moving and moving. So in part, Bella's great quote really sort of, I think, represents that whole movement that ultimately ended up with the 19th Amendment. And then one more thing, being the first female nominee for governor, my paper boy one day calls me up and says, "I was at an antique store and I just bought you something." "I don't need anything," I said. "No, no, you need this. You owe me $25. So he brings in this huge black and white photo of the 1921 New Hampshire legislature. Now, women got the right to vote in 1920. The 1921 picture, there are 400 members in the New Hampshire legislature. It's the biggest state legislature in the country. Only Congress is bigger. There are two women. They ran as write-ins, everyone. One was a Republican and one was a Democrat. on their shoulders I climb. So I think my assignment for you is go back to 1921, find out how many women who didn't have that history of voting, because there are other states that obviously had allowed women that franchise, but find out about those first women. They ran as write-ins. Oh my God, I'm so proud of them. So I'm gonna start with you, Diane. The 19 facts about the 19th Amendment. Let's start with sort of going through what you think are the most important, because I think it's really important to understand who these suffragists were.
Well, I think the thing that Karen and I were trying to achieve in this is that, especially within some of the narrative today, I think, you know, one of the things I start with when I talk about the suffrage movement, you know, it was over 7 decades long. So it was a very complicated movement. So it's really hard to sort of synthesize what the movement was. And we tried to do so with these 19 points and, you know, thinking that, okay, we had a word limit. So we were trying to, you know, so we collaborated when we could meet in person back in January and just kind of collaborate on what 19 things that we wanted to focus on. And so, you know, we began with the roots of the movement and the abolitionist movement, and then kind of went on somewhat chronologically, ending with the ERA. But, you know, what we tried to, I think, demonstrate in these kind of bullet points was it was a long movement. It had leadership at the national and local level. Men had to be supportive of suffrage or it wouldn't have passed in the states that it did. So it was a movement where you had to convince men to extend the franchise to women. You had women and men, but women who were opposed to suffrage. You had a lot of diverse voices. And I think that's been overlooked a little bit today is that, and I think in a way that's kind of discounts it. I mean, it was a movement led primarily by middle-class white women. I mean, that's true. And that's how sort of the movement, the women's rights movements of the 70s also has been criticized. But there were diverse voices in there. There were, especially from African-American women, women that were working-class women, women that were in farm unions. And so it was really more of a diverse movement. And then I think finally what I'd say is that Karen and I thought it was really important to frame this within the context of today. And as what you, you know, referred to with what happened in Georgia yesterday is that, you know, sort of like we all seem to want to stop at like, okay, well, there's a Voting Rights Act of 1965. And so now everything is great. Well, it's not. And we didn't include Shelby County versus Holder in there. But today it's the same thing as fighting for these rights that the suffragists did. I mean, we still, so to me, let's focus on that as a result of the suffrage campaign.
It is a continuation of that movement. And I want to go back to one of the first thing that you wrote, Karen. You wrote, many early suffragists were also abolitionists, okay? I want people to hear the combination. You know, I think about the woman that most inspired me to get political was Shirley Chisholm. That's my role model for politics. I wanted to be just like her. I wanted to follow in her footsteps. That was my role model. You write, they included Lucretia Mott, Elizabeth Cady Stanton, Susan B. Anthony, Lucy Stone, Sojourner Truth, Frederick Douglass, and Harriet Tubman. And I want people, I think that's really important for people to understand that there was this interesting marriage between the suffragettes and the abolitionists, that they understood why they needed each other.
Exactly. And as Frederick Douglass especially referred to, is to understand that the right to vote for one oppressed group was an unfulfilled promise if it didn't extend to the rest of the population. He called himself a woman's rights man, and he was actually quite supportive of suffrage throughout his entire life. But also the women who were involved in the abolition movement gained some important organizational skills. You know, it was at an abolitionist conference in 1840 in London where Lucretia Mott and Elizabeth Cady Stanton were marginalized. They were forced to sit in the back of the area, the auditorium where the sessions were being held, and behind a screen, and they were not allowed to participate, even though Lucretia Mott was actually a voting delegate from the United States. And it was at that point that they began to think that maybe there needed to be some liberation of other women's groups as well. And then we see that African American rights, the civil rights movements of the different eras, and suffrage actually sort of move along together. And there's a lot of intersections between them throughout the history of the entire movement. And so you really can't understand suffrage without looking at the intersectionality with the national conversations about race.
Again, Diane, you mentioned that as we look at this moment, we really need to see the connection, the intersectionality. In a lot of ways, I feel like it's it's deja vu all over again. We're realizing how important we are to each other, and that the challenge is so much of what we face, we will only enhance each other if we work together. And that's really what I think we're seeing, and hopefully we'll see in 2020. But I thought was interesting. So you talk about Seneca Falls. So Diane, what I think is, like, really, just to show how pivotal voting was, but how difficult it was, Hugh writes that there were 11 resolutions demanding equality in the workplace, and family, and education. This is the kicker. Only women's right to vote drew opposition before it was approved. Oh my God, check my pulse. What was the point? I mean, well, if you cared about what happened in the workplace and you cared about the family, you knew you couldn't think it through. It needed to have policy support. And why would you not want to participate in that policy?
There were actually, I think, Karen, I think it was Lucretia Mott's husband that was actually opposed to that. He was so they were focusing on these rights. And so it was very controversial, but it was really, and again, we had to pare down this bullet to kind of explain this, but it was actually Frederick. So the first day, there was about 240 people that were involved in this 2-day conference. And the first day was for women, and then they allowed men the second day. And Frederick Douglass was one of them, the men that attended. And Elizabeth Cady Stanton had written that as one of the resolutions, but then it met with all this, you know, people, they were actually, from what I've read, and again, it was in the bullet at one point in time, but they were afraid they were going to be ridiculed. And they actually were, you know, later on in the press, they were ridiculed for demanding the right to vote. But it was Frederick Douglass that really spoke very eloquently, saying, you know, we don't get all this other stuff. You know, he understood, like Karen has just said, we don't get this other stuff without the right to vote. And so he spoke in favor of it. So it did pass. It was not unanimous, but it did pass, and it was really him supporting Elizabeth Cady Stanton. And of course, he was a wonderful orator and just spoke on the fact, and I think helped them connect the dots. But these women, many of them thought, if we have this, we're going to be made fun of. And they were in the press, like, can you believe they even asked for the right to vote? And so they were ridiculed, but that did pass. And it really was with the help of Frederick Douglass, who really did see the intersections between all these other reforms and the right to vote.
Just to show you how crazy I am. So I'm reading all this, and there's a part of it where I start crying when I'm reading it, and I'm so emotional. But it took me back to something that you're going to be surprised by. I lived on Loring Park in Minneapolis, Minnesota, back in 1976, I think it was. And there was a Episcopalian church at the corner, and they were voting on the ordination of women. And it was literally four doors from my apartment. I remember sitting there listening on the steps to the fight about it. And I feel like in so many ways, I was listening to a fight that was taking place in the 1800s about women and the right to vote and their full franchise and their full humanity. And I'm thinking, this is 1976. This is, you know, I mean, how is this possible today? And yet I think people need to understand that it has been a long slog. We're not even close to parity. And yet you have to be so grateful to these people for not giving up, for being arrested, for being sent to jail, for doing all these things. And I keep thinking, you know, people are talking about how tough it is to socially isolate and wear a mask. And I'm going, oh my God, you have no clue. You have no clue. So the other thing, Karen, that I think, you talked about the fact that there was the abolitionist movement and the suffragette movement, and they saw themselves as intertwined. And then, of course, what you have is the 15th Amendment. Now, the 15th Amendment does expand the franchise. But let's remind our audience what happened. Because once again, women went to the back, there was no bus back then, but they went to the back of the, you know, the buggy. But there was a real split about whether they should support the 15th Amendment, which gave African-American men the franchise.
Yeah. So if you recall your American history, there were three really crucial constitutional amendments that were passed after the Civil War. So the 13th Amendment that abolished slavery, the 14th Amendment that we know of today as protecting due process and equal protection of the laws, and the 15th Amendment, which eliminated race as a reason to deprive people of the right to vote. And there's nothing in the 15th Amendment by itself that is restricted to men. Where you get that is by looking at the 14th Amendment. And the 14th Amendment, for the first time, defines citizens and voters as male. So it is the first time the word male or any gender-specific term enters the Constitution. Before that, You had words like electors, representatives, they were all gender neutral terms. Well, Elizabeth Cady Stanton was vociferously opposed to the 14th Amendment, and she said very famously, if you put the word male in the Constitution, it will take 100 years to get it out. And actually, if you read the 14th Amendment, the word male is still there. She was wrong. It hasn't been removed from the Constitution. So by implication then, the 15th Amendment only applied to African-American men. And a number of suffragists, again, who were also abolitionists, made the strategic, including Frederick Douglass and Lucretia Mott and Lucy Stone, made the sort of strategic decision that they would support the 15th Amendment, even though it excluded women. And the argument was that it is the black man's turn. And the argument in favor of that was both political expediency, that if women had been included, the whole amendment would be killed. But also, Frederick Douglass called to the suffering of black men under slavery, arguing that they needed the vote because of the horrors of slavery that they had endured.
Not that African American women also were slaved and also were sold and also picked cotton. And
and saw their children sold and
put
up and all of the horrors of slavery that were visited upon African-American women.
I fought Martin Luther King's birthday for Martin Luther King's birthday in New Hampshire. We were the last state in the nation to embrace Martin Luther King's birthday. I remember the big fight when they wanted to pass, and they did pass, Civil Rights Day before they passed Martin Luther King Day. I wanted none of it. I would have been one of those suffragettes that would have said no to the 15th Amendment. You know, I was like, I want Martin Luther King Day. I don't want this. I guess by 1999, we finally kicking and dragging. We made Martin Luther King Day a holiday. There's a sense of frustration and also an understanding that maybe this is a building process and maybe you bring people in to support you. And in this case, maybe by recognizing the rights of African-American men, that gives you more voters that will then support the idea of the suffragette moment and of women in politics. But also remind people that the 19th Amendment didn't turn the switch on for the country. Because Diane, my understanding is there were a lot of states that had already passed some variation on a theme allowing women the right to vote. I noticed that a lot of those states were out in the West.
West,
yeah. And it was almost like, okay, girls, please move out. If you move out, we'll give you the vote. I mean, come on. You know, it's like, we don't want you to stay on the East Coast. If you come here, we're going to give you added value, you know? And I'm always wondering whether there was a piece of that in there. But let's talk a little bit about the states that actually gave women the right to vote. Because once again, it was men that had to do it because they're the ones that had the franchise. But they also understood why expanding the franchise was good for their states.
Well, this actually started happening after the two associations split in 1869, American Women's Suffrage Association, National Women's Suffrage Association. American, who supported the 15th Amendment, supported a state-by-state strategy. The National, which had wanted a federal constitutional amendment, they joined together in 1890, and that's when they actually started making progress. So Wyoming, Montana, Utah, Washington State coming on board pretty early on. So really what happened, and this gets a little bit to Carrie Chapman Catt's winning plan, and actually maybe why the Equal Rights Amendment didn't pass the way the suffrage amendment did, is that by 1920, before the amendment was ratified, women had full voting rights in 15 states plus the Alaska Territory. It was a territory at the time. And then they had partial voting rights, including presidential suffrage. And so like in Nebraska, where I'm living now, women could vote before the 19th Amendment on, we got school suffrage first, then municipal, and then we got presidential suffrage, which meant we could vote here. Not we, but my family that lived here at the time could vote for presidential electors. And so you had about those 20, let's see, there was then 27 states, that had this. One of the things that Catt did with her winning plan is that it really basically focused, and that was from 1915 to 1920, it focused on a federal constitutional amendment while still encouraging work in the states. And basically what she got the states to sign is that she got 36 states, so she had these like 27 states, and then she got these other 30, she really came up with 36 states that women in those states were committed to working for suffrage. And so it was some kind of pact. And so you had to kind of sign on. And so she focused on these 36 states. They did not include many states in the South. But as part of her campaign, she realized that most of these states that had extended suffrage to women were Western states. So she worked on two campaigns in New York State. I think the first one was 1915 and it failed, and the second one was 1917, which was successful. And so what that did is that played a big role in convincing not only some members of Congress, but also President Wilson to support the 19th Amendment, which he did in 1918.
But again, let's talk a little bit about Wilson. Because let's talk about the women that were marching in front of the White House. Just want everyone to know, we should do a split screen. We should do what happened with Black Lives Matter in front of the White House, and then we should do the suffragettes in front of the White House. Because the reaction of the president is kind of similar, Karen. Why don't you tell our audience what these women went through, how they were arrested, what they were fed, so people understand that, you know, Donald Trump, there is a little bit of history here for his over-the-top behavior, because Wilson exhibited that same kind of treatment to the women who are all, what were they asking for? They're asking for the right to vote.
Right. So today we are so accustomed to the idea that there are protests going on outside of the White House. So that's a symbolic place where we gather and we participate with our bodies and ourselves to make a political statement. But what I find really remarkable is that it's only been about 100 years that that has been a part of American tradition. And the very first people who demonstrated outside of the White House demanding the right to vote, any demonstrations outside the White House were suffragists. Yeah, this was organized by a competing organization to Carrie Chapman Catt's, which is called the National Woman's Party, which was led by Alice Paul, who really represents the third generation of activists. She was about 30 years younger than Carrie Chapman Catt. The National Women's Party split from Carrie Chapman Catt's organization to create a more militant brand that focused solely on the Federal Amendment. And so what they started to do was to picket outside the White House. Paul called them the Silent Sentinels. They were out there 6 days a week in every kind of weather. They stood mostly silently, only answered questions if asked, and they held banners. And these banners said things like, calling to mind what they saw as the hypocrisy of Wilson's support for democracy. Our justification for World War I was to make the world safe for democracy and to bring democracy to Europe, when in fact we had half the population disenfranchised, or in many states disenfranchised in part or completely. And they were arrested. They were taken to the Occoquan work camp in Northern Virginia. They were engaged in forced labor. They were fed food that was filled with maggots and sawdust. And one of the games that they played was to count who had the most maggots in their food. And to protest these conditions, they began to hunger strike. Over 30 women hunger struck. And this sort of galvanized public opinion behind the suffragists and the horrific treatment that they had.
And as you write, they were released after the Washington, D.C. Court of Appeals, judges matter, everyone, Mitch McConnell knows that too, and declared their arrests unconstitutional. I really do think that this story is why I'm going to end this conversation, because as we're watching what's going on, you know, building the fence, watching the arrests of so many people, watching the pepper spray, watching all this, and we're sort of horrified at the behavior of Donald Trump, I want people to know it's happened before. And your point that these were the first people to ever picket in front of the White House were a group of remarkable women suffragettes who went to prison, who ate this food, who were beaten and tortured. There is a theme here. But the theme also means that persistence is critical. And again, I'm going to end with that famous Bella Abzug quote. You have to lose, lose, lose to win, to win. There is a process. There is an erosion of the negative because you're learning every time you lose. And yet in the end, if you show that persistence and that diligence, and you've got, in this case, the right on your side, that women should be able to participate and exercise the franchise, you understand why you can't stop. And I think we're seeing that now with Black Lives Matter. They're demanding change. They've said we've waited since we came over, you know, in chains. And now it's time for us to be seen as equals. Thank you so very much, Karen and Diane. I really appreciate it.
Thank you
for having us.
It's a pleasure. All right, everyone. We will schmooze tomorrow. This is The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and producer Dave Scott and Stephanie Collins. Thanks for listening. You better think about what you're trying to do to me. Think. Let your mind go, let yourself be free. Let's go back. Let's go way on the way back when. I didn't even know you. You couldn't have been too much more than 10. Just